Hi guys, it has been a while. I usually don't go this long between episodes. It's been really strange to not be in front of the microphone, but as I've already mentioned 10 times, so you're sick of hearing it, I'm sure, my family and I recently moved houses and my kids finished school and our lives have just been different schedules, different days going by in the blink of an eye as we have these changes. But things have finally settled down a little bit. So I am back for the Unsinkable season one finale, which is this, a Kate Winslet retrospective. First thing I want to say is that I usually go into these episodes with a pretty ironclad script. I think I've mentioned that before. I over-prepare for most of them. And sometimes I end up going a little bit off script. I'm sure it's obvious in my ums and ahs and things like that. But for this one, I just honestly didn't have time. But also when I thought about scripting my thoughts about Kate Winslet, that just didn't seem right. And for the Leo retrospective I did a few months ago, same thing. It just didn't feel right to write a script. So this episode will be a little bit more conversational than they sometimes are, which is fun to experiment with. It's how my bonus episodes kind of are. And also looking ahead to the fall as I plan season two, I think one of the things I want to do is have a more conversational tone with guests and also just with, you know, maybe having some people on that I know in real life. And we have sort of a, you know, not, I mean, I've loved my interviews, but some feedback that I've received and just my own personal observations. I think some of my interviews just come off as a bit formal, which they need to be sometimes, you know, when you're talking to an expert. Like just a couple of weeks ago, I had Stephen Beal on, who is a professor at Harvard. He is a Titanic expert bona fide. And in those situations, sometimes more formal is called for. But I think some of my favorite podcasts are the ones where when guests come on, there is a little bit of a rapport between whoever that guest is and the host. And that back and forth, conversational, feeling comfortable joking, feeling comfortable telling stories, sometimes maybe even personal stories. I think it's a great style for podcasting. I'm interested in exploring that as well. And anyway, we'll talk about that a little bit more at the end. I'll do a little preview of what's to come starting in the fall. But yeah, so this is really casual. My brain is completely 100% fried, as you can imagine. And it's a good thing I decided to send the podcast on a hiatus for the summer for the main feed because, yes, with my children at home, I don't get any work done at all, just as predicted, which is wonderfully beautiful. You know, they're home for the summer and summertime with kids this age, they're 6 and 7, is amazing, you know, just like sleeping in, making s'mores in the fire pit in the backyard, you know, tons of swimming. Lots of sibling fighting and things like that as well, but it's just that, you know, summertime vibe, which is great. And so I'm not complaining, but definitely not, would not be able to produce the quality of work during the summer with them at home that you are used to. So this has been a good plan. All right, before I get into Kate, I want to thank my newest Patreon subscribers. I forgot last week and I'm so sorry. So I want to thank Missy and I want to thank Jeff. You guys, and I say this every time, it means the world that you've invested in Unsinkable and that it's something that you're, you know, interested in supporting and communicating with me and being a part of the process. It's so amazing. So thank you. And I do want to remind you that if you're considering joining Patreon for Unsinkable, there's no break on that for this summer. So the bonus episodes will keep posting. I'll have one in June and July and then August and so on and so on. But basically there will be content there over the summer when there is not new content on the main feed. The main feed may end up with a little bit of strange content. I don't know. I'm contemplating doing a couple of sort of experimental side episodes on the main feed, but that's just dependent on the amount of time I have. And I'm not 100% on that. But what I can promise you is that the bonus content on Patreon will continue through the summer. So if you'd like to have some content still in the summer, it's a good option. There's lots of different tiers to join at. And that is at it's not at unsinkablepod.com. And by the way, I need to update my website. I've fallen down on that end. It is at patreon.com/unsinkablepod. All right, Kate. So I did hear from a few of you in my call for Kate Love Notes, and I'm going to play some at the end and read some at the end here. I know it was a big ask to sort of put yourself out there like that, to be on the pod. So it's really amazing to me that some of you did that. And I can't wait to play those. Again, this is casual. And I'm not going to mention every single movie that she's been in. There is a string of movies in the early 2000s and then one in the mid 2000s where, I mean, not that the movies aren't quality, definitely worth watching, but just aren't ones that, at least for me, really stand out as important either to my kind of, you know, micro history of my life and cinema, or just how I feel about her. So it won't be comprehensive, I guess. You may, you know, the episode may end and you may scream, she didn't mention Collateral Beauty. She didn't talk about Enigma properly. And I know that for every movie, there are people who, you know, may resonate for, and it didn't for me. I'm going to mention a couple of her movies that I personally think are at the top of the list of her filmography, and people may disagree. So I 100% understand there may be some movies I skip that are important to you. And if so, send me a message. Would love to chat about it and hear your input. So the first, you know, interaction that I think people a little older than me had with Kate was with Heavenly Creatures. I was born in 1984, you know, so in the mid-90s, I was anywhere from, you know, it was in that 10 to 13 range. I think people in their later teens and certainly early 20s, there was this, you know, very dramatic and almost frenetic introduction to her via the Peter Jackson movie, Heavenly Creatures. It was an early film of his. And it was based on a real life murder case from 1954 in Christchurch, I believe the Parker Hume murder. And she, Kate, kind of came out of nowhere seemingly at this point. And I think that was in 94. Let me do some real life. Hey, some of my favorite podcasts that I listen to do real life Googling. So here you go. I'm going to do it too, just this one time. Yeah, 1994. So seemingly Kate comes out of nowhere, but that never really is the case, right? I mean, actors and actresses don't just come out of nowhere. She had been doing British television before this, but she is cast by Peter Jackson in this iconic, strange, yeah, frenetic, frantic role of Juliet in Heavenly Creatures, playing a teenager that is involved in this very intense relationship with another teenager played by Melanie Lynskey. And they're plotting this murder to kill Melanie Lynskey's character's mom. That was not my first introduction to Kate. I was too young to be seeing, you know, indie movies of that level and caliber at that point. So I didn't see that until much, much later. My introduction to Kate, and that's not to dismiss that movie at all. It's an incredible movie. And if you haven't seen it, it's go watch it tonight, basically, Heavenly Creatures. My introduction to Kate was in Sense and Sensibility. And I firmly believe, you know, even almost, gosh, almost 30 years later, which is hard to swallow. I still think it's the best Jane Austen adaptation in film, perhaps ever, with a script by Emma Thompson and directed by Ang Lee. I am unshockingly a big Jane Austen person. I don't think that that will bring anybody any shock. I remember seeing it, and it came out in 95. I remember seeing it. I saw it with my mom. And I think it's a Jane Austen adaptation that not only bridges ages. I mean, I think anybody from, you know, age 8 to 99 can watch that movie, of course, but also bridges Jane Austen people and non-Jane Austen people. I think you can be a non-Jane Austen person and watch that movie and think, wow, this is an excellent film, which not all Jane Austen adaptations are. So that was my introduction, and I was so obsessed with the sister dynamic in that movie because I have had and have sisters, and I think I wanted to just live in that world, the cozy little cottage that they end up in that is, you know, damp and they say is not very nice, but to me that little cottage on the hill still looked like a British mansion that I wanted to live in. And I think I probably was the only 11. I was probably the only 11-year-old in the world in love with Alan Rickman, who he plays Colonel Brandon, who Marianne, Kate's character, eventually ends up with. Spoiler alert, but I mean, the book's hundreds of years old and the movie is almost 30 years old. So sorry, but I just, you know, the casting there was interesting because she was so young. I think she would have been, you know, what, like barely 20 at that time. And Alan Rickman, I believe, was already in his 40s, but Alan Rickman, RIP, him in that role, just this quiet, you know, respectful, older gentleman who's, you know, has gone through loss. And he is kind of the good guy among the smarmy men of the era. And he just is kind of quietly in the corner waiting for Marianne to fall in love with him. And I don't know, right? Something about that. But I was in love with Alan Rickman. And I was in love also a little bit with Kate Winslet, I think, already at that point. And I remember thinking at that age that if I ever had a daughter, I would name her Marianne. And I love how Marianne is spelled in that book. It's Marianne. And my real name is Leslie Ann. That's where the LA comes from, with an E on the end of Ann. So I thought that was so cool. I don't know why that thought really left me. I do have a daughter. I did not name her Marianne. Anyway, so that was my first introduction. I still have the hardback copy of the novel with the movie cover. And I don't know if they do this as much anymore, but they used to do these. Y'all remember when they used to do these tie-ins when they would do a film adaptation of a book? They would release, you know, you'd go into Barnes & Noble and it'd be at the front of the store, but they would release the novel hardback with this gorgeous book jacket with the film poster cover. But I had this one and I still have it. And my mom wrote in it, beautiful inscription. My mom passed away when I was 17, so just a few years after that. And I'm not one of those people that keeps boxes and boxes of memory things. I like little things. I like to remember people and places by things that I can actually put on my shelf, display, you know, put into a little sort of, you know, curated display kind of thing. So I don't really have a ton of things that I keep out in my house that reminds me of my mom. Just a few select things, but that is one of them. Is every house I've ever lived in, I have that book out on the bookshelf with the inscription, and Kate's gorgeous face is on the cover. So anyway, it's really special. All right. I do want to mention A Kid in King Arthur's Court, which was a Disney movie in 95. And I think one of Kate's only true, you know, commercial, very commercial choices at this point. And she plays the maiden at the castle. And of course, you know, like, I think she got this nickname around this time in Hollywood is like Corset Kate. So, but you know, this movie, I remember watching it and getting it from Blockbuster at the time. I think after Titanic came out, because I just wanted to see everything that she'd ever been in. But it's cute. And if you have kids that are the target demographic, you know, anywhere from 5 to 10 probably on a movie like that. Watch it. It's on Disney Plus. I showed it to my kids during one of the lockdowns during COVID, and we just randomly, you know, always looking for something to watch, and they loved it. And she's beautiful and fun in that. She's very young, so just a note. There was Jude the Obscure, which was a very gritty film adaptation of a Thomas Hardy novel, which is very difficult to get through, both the book and the movie. I believe it was Thomas Hardy's last novel. I read it. I actually have read a lot of Hardy over the years and did when I was a teenager, but I read this one in particular because it was a Kate movie. And I had this kind of running deal with my parents. By the way, my dad listens to the pod sometimes, so if you come across this one, Pops, you know, thanks for this way back the day. Sort of had this running deal that if, especially coming out of Titanic, obviously, if Kate or Leo were in a movie, then the rating didn't matter, which is crazy. But I showed such an obsessive need at the time to watch anything that had Kate or Leo in it that would develop into fights at Blockbuster. And if you're too young to know the Blockbuster era, I feel so bad for you. And not in a condescending way. I don't mean that to come off as mean. I do feel bad for you. This is such a beautiful experience to go to Blockbuster and pick out a movie and see what was in. But we would have these fights at Blockbuster over the content on some of these movies. And finally, if it was Kate or Leo, I would be allowed, even though I was, you know, still a pretty young teen. And Jude the Obscure is, you know, it's a heady and heavy novel. It's about a working class protagonist. It's about, you know, class and education. And, you know, he marries his cousin. They have a tumultuous life. There is the death of children in the book. That is very much about the hardened life that they lead. And the movie is very graphic depictions of all of this. So, you know, it's actually weirdly a movie that I watched at the time, and as a kid, I probably shouldn't have been watching it, but it affected me, but didn't, you know, horrify me. But now as a parent, I know that if I went back and tried to watch that movie, I wouldn't sit well. So it's not one that I have returned to, but it is a gorgeously shot movie, and it is really great work by her. And then there is Hamlet, which came out in 1996, and it was Kenneth Branagh's adaptation, obviously, of Shakespeare. This one is very long. I remember owning the double cassette, just like Titanic was a double cassette. This Hamlet was a double cassette because it was so long. I believe it might be 4 hours. If you've never seen it and you're a Shakespeare person, it's a fantastic adaptation. You know, Kenneth Branagh is incredible. His most recent film, Belfast, came out last year. If you haven't seen it, just side note, I think was one of the best of the year, and it got sort of buried in the awards season there at the end, but it was a really beautiful little movie, and I highly recommend it. But yeah, Kenneth Branagh's Hamlet. You know, Kate Winslet is Ophelia, and I remember seeing this movie and just her hair, the long wavy hair, and she's in the white nightgown, and I just, the expressions on her face, the wide eyes, the way her face was shaped, just completely 100% enamored. I need to revisit that movie. I haven't in years. I think I watched it probably 10 times in the 90s. And I'm not a huge Shakespeare person, but the acting in that movie is incredible. So highly recommend. And if you're a Kenneth Branagh person, then you're probably thinking, I have not given enough time to this and need to talk about it for 20 minutes because it is a really important movie in 96. But then we get to Titanic, right? And I've talked about Titanic so much on the main feed. In fact, some of you, you know, probably think to yourself, is this a podcast about Titanic the ship or Titanic the movie? And to be perfectly honest, it's about both. I think as the podcast has evolved, it's become even more about the cultural memory of the movie. And I'm really happy with that. I think it's a good balance. And I know I've heard from a lot of y'all that I'll talk about it at the end, but some cool ideas to how to sort of incorporate the movie a little bit more into some of the historical analyses and in other episodes in the fall. So we get to Titanic, and I think Kate and to a lesser extent Leo, but him as well, is defined so much by this role. You know, if you search for Kate Winslet on Google image search, or, you know, just in meme land or Instagram, whatever it may be, you know, this is what pops up is, you know, her flying on the bow of the ship. So I can't imagine what it must be like in her mind to look back on Titanic 25 years later. I've heard her speak in interviews off and on over the years, and she seems a very appropriate amount of grateful for the doors that that role opened up and for the doors that sort of the iconic nature of that movie opened up. And I think she has, and Leo's talked about it less over the years, in fact, not much at all. But she talks about it really openly, which I appreciate. And she has a great balance of appreciating it, but also having moved on from it into obviously lots of different levels of her career. She, I think, oh gosh, I can't remember if it was on David Letterman. No, Stephen Colbert, because it was more recent than that. I think it was on Stephen Colbert. I think it was the episode where at the end, she and Stephen Colbert try to recreate the being on the piece of wood, if you've seen that episode. But she talks about taking her son to see a screening of Titanic randomly one afternoon and how weird that was. And I think halfway through the movie, he wanted to leave and have dessert and he didn't want to watch it anymore. And, you know, it's just, God, she said, you know, she walks into places and people will start playing My Heart Will Go On. And it's just, it must be something so strange to live with. But she seems to have such a joy about it. She genuinely looks joyful when she talks about it, you know, and we'll talk about it here at the end. But she, you know, went on to work with James Cameron again. So, you know, I went over it in the Leo retrospective, but I saw Titanic 13 times in the movie theater. And I told my husband this recently. We, one of my recent rewatches, because I do actually watch it all the time still. It's not a joke. When their names came up at the end, you know, when it says Leonardo DiCaprio and Kate Winslet, I told him, and I had this realization for the first time within myself that, you know, what would happen to me every time those credits popped up is I would see their names and I would think to myself, I have to see this one more time. And it was just this feeling in me when I saw those names that I have to see these people do this one more time on this screen in this magical place. And the 13th time, I don't know what happened. I guess the 13th time I didn't have that feeling and I knew it was time to let go. pardon the pun. So 13 times, and I can still remember what it felt like to sit in that seat. I was an awkward 13-year-old, braces, frizzy hair. You know, everyone is wearing 90s clothes again. Unironically, which one is it? I don't know. You know, high-waisted acid wash jeans and random t-shirts and things like that. And I actually think it's really cute on some people, but was it cute on an awkward 13-year-old who was just, you know, wearing whatever was in her closet? It wasn't style, you know, that was me, right? In the like Zima jeans. Was it Zina? Zima is the drink, right? There was like a brand of jeans though that started with an S, but you know, I didn't have it together, which I'm grateful for. I think to go through an awkward phase as a teenager with the braces and the pimples and the frizzy hair and the style not figured out. That's what makes, at least for me, that was part of what made me as I evolved as a person to go through an awkward stage from kind of figuring things out. And Titanic was a big part of that. It gave me the confidence to love something unabashedly. And that's what I hear from a lot of women who have messaged me who were a similar age in 97. I hear it again and again. So I think there's something to it. And I've said it before, but I think one of the reasons that Titanic gets kind of on is because it is something that women love. It is something that girls love. It is something that girls love unabashedly and with this, you know, what some people would deem cheesy sort of, you know, fascination. And so, of course, that gets dumped on, you know, whereas things that that men or boys tend to nerd out on don't. So it infuriates me to no end. But what Titanic gave us as 13-year-old girls in that situation was something we could confidently love that was part of this big monocultural moment. And, you know, I sat there and I just fell in love with both of those people, with Kate and with Leo. And I remember Kate's Rolling Stone cover, a gorgeous cover where she's in the rowboat. I had that on my wall. Her movie line, do you guys remember the magazine Movie Line? I would, every month I just would, I mean, I would cut out pictures, put them on my wall. It was all the upcoming movies. It was before the internet was where you got all of your information about what movies were coming out. It's like you read the paper, you read magazines, and there was so much anticipation. And, you know, release dates could change and you wouldn't know because everybody wasn't talking about it on the internet. Long story short. But I had the Movie Line, that issue. I remember she was in like a silver dress with like straightened hair, looking very dramatic in that one. I remember her Oprah appearance, and I've gone back and I've watched it. And it, rewatching the Oprah appearance really brings me to one of my big questions coming out of you know, the cultural memory of her in Titanic and then the kind of the legacy of her in Titanic, which is, I think, that she is often defined by her relationship to Leo more so than he is defined by his relationship to her. I would be interested to hear your thoughts on that. And I don't mean that as a negative thing. I mean, she very openly and joyfully talked about him then and still talks about him now. And I know that their friendship is this thing that has endured out of Titanic, right? Neither one of them really talks Titanic obsessively, but what we see over the last 25 years is that the two of them have seemed to stay very close and seem to, you know, openly adore one another. And this, you know, when we see the paparazzi shots or we see the red carpet shots of them together, like the year that Leo won the Oscar, she was there, they were there on the red carpet, those, the genuine smiles, it's, I think if you are a Titanic person from 97, it's a really important big legacy. Not that I want to pry into anybody's personal life. I notoriously do not want to. I said it in the Leo episode and I'll say it now. When I do these types of things, I don't mention people's private lives very much. That's not what I'm here for. I think that actually what Kate and Leo have done, what sets them apart as great movie stars and icons, is that they've done a really good job of letting their work speak for itself. And they don't rely on social media or let us into every little single detail of their lives. They shouldn't have to. I think the balance that they've struck is kind of amazing. And it's what makes them special. It's what makes them seem both relatable and larger than life, which is a weird combination to be able to pull off as a woman or as a man, I think. So, you know, I think one of the enduring legacies of that cultural moment in 97 is this friendship that they still have. You know, every few years there's photos that'll pop up of them hanging out at a beach or a pool, or they both end up at an event and we get these wonderful, sweet photos. And I don't know, I just, There's something so rewarding about that, because I think if you were 13 in 97 or 15 or whatever, you really just wanted to think that somehow, some way, Jack and Rose ended up together, right? And if Kate and Leo having this very special, beautiful friendship that endures, if that's, I don't know, I just feel like that's some version of that, and that's some fantasy that we get to live out as their fans. So that may sound really dumb and stupid, but to me, it's just so sweet, I guess I'll use that word for the 15th time. But I do think it's interesting. I think she perhaps is defined a little bit more by that than him. And I don't know if there's a gender dynamic there at play, and not to get too serious in what is a very fun conversation, but it is something to think about. I do think when you consider what is a movie star and what movie stars and what imagery sticks with us, I think that Kate getting out of the car in that opening Southampton scene is one of the top five of all time. If you think about leading lady entrances in epic movies and great Hollywood films, when she steps out of that car in that purple hat and her face tilts up, that's, you know, 100 years from now, people will be talking about that scene. That's great filmmaking. And that is her with that, the glamour glint in her eye. It's just incredible. I think another candidate would be her walking down the staircase in the black dress at dinner or heading to dinner. So I think she has done, as we'll talk about, a really great job of taking on all sorts of roles over the years and trying on so many different parts. But I think you can't erase the fact that that is her, those are her sort of movie star making moments. And I mean, what better ones are there? Like, that's, I don't know, just when you think about the colors and the lighting and the energy of that moment. Anyway, can't top it. So I recently, there was a lot of like to do at the time about what her and Leo's first roles would be after Titanic. And for her, it was a really interesting choice. She chose to do a pretty small independent film called Hideous Kinky. It was based on a novel. It's about a very young mother who goes to Marrakesh as a single mother with her two young girls. And I remember seeing it at the time. Again, you know, one of my blockbuster finds. We didn't have theaters. I grew up in Shreveport, Louisiana. We didn't have movie theaters that were really showing independent film that much. So I would mostly have to wait until things came out on video. But I remember seeing it and you know, just loving it because she was in it. But I wasn't really old enough to have very deeply formed opinions about cinema yet. So, but I rewatched it just the other night. It's on Tubi, little Tubi find. Definitely recommend it. And it holds up strikingly well. There's definitely a little bit of an air of look at these scenes of Moroccans being Moroccan. And I don't know if that holds up in the sense that film nowadays does a really, really great job of exploring, you know, cultures and diverse characters. But I would say that there are a couple of characters in Hideous Kinky, including one of the men, Moroccan men that Kate Winslet's character gets involved with, that are actually really, really well written. And the acting is superb. And she is superb in it. The vulnerability, the sort of quiet power, but also fear of that character. It's a beautifully shot movie. It has some gut-wrenching moments. I don't remember how successful it was at the time, but it is a little gem of a movie. I would highly recommend. It's on Tubi, like I said, for free. So to me, the other night, just sitting down in front of my TV in 2022 and watching this 1998 movie, that there was all this expectation around because it was her first coming out of Titanic. But with all of that taken away from it, just to see her, you know, at that age, she's still about the Titanic age, early 20s at that point in this role, I don't know. It's just, I recommend if you have actors and actresses that you sort of worship and love, go back to the early filmography once in a while and just rediscover. And I've done that with quite a few actors that I like recently in, you know, the COVID era. So we've all been home a lot more over the last couple of years and watched a lot more movies probably than we ever have. That's one of the things I've done, is just sort of pick someone that I like and I go back to their early moments. And I highly recommend that as an experience. So Hideous Kinky, great little movie. Holy Smoke, Jane Campion film, Forgotten, with Kate Winslet and with Harvey Keitel. And of course, Jane Campion, you know, multiple awards, huge, huge film last year with Power of the Dog. And she kind of finally had her big moment that's been building since The Piano. And this movie seems to be forgotten in her filmography. People don't talk about it a lot. I was a little traumatized by it at the time because I was very young, like, you know, 14, 15. And Holy Smoke, just fair warning, is not for your child. I mean, it is some very explicit sexual content. It is about Harvey Keitel is a cult deprogrammer, and Kate Winslet's character is her parents. I think it's her parents that sent her to be sort of deprogrammed, but then she ends up manipulating him. It's a very psychological, very sexual. So definitely I would say like 16 and up, but I don't know. I haven't admittedly gone back and rewatched it yet. I meant to for this, and my husband wants to see it because he's never seen it, but I haven't had time yet. I'll report back on social media. And then, you know, there are these early 2000s dramas, Quills, Enigma. I haven't revisited either one of these. I'm sure that they're strong films, just not ones that stuck with me. One that really stuck with me was Iris, about the writer Iris Murdoch. This is the one where she plays the young version and then Judi Dench plays the older version. It was one of the first times that actresses were nominated for Oscars for playing the same part. And I remember hearing that this was happening, and I got the book that it was based on and read a little bit about Iris Murdoch's life. It is a criminally forgotten film. I definitely recommend going back and watching it if you haven't, or rewatching it. It's a lovely movie. Jim Broadbent is in it and fantastic in it as well. So just a little love note to Iris. I would definitely look it up. There's an animated movie that she did around this time called A Christmas Carol. And I really shocked the pants off my husband, John, a couple of years ago when I showed him the music video. But she sings a song in this film, for it's animated, but it's like the, you know, love theme, and it's called What If. And I think the backstory on it is that the producers came to her and said, she was voicing a character, and said, you know, let's do a song. The proceeds will go. What I think, no, I think Kate suggested the proceeds go to charity, but they wanted her to do it. I'm sure it was just a PR kind of, you know, her Titanic level of fame. And she has, you know, obviously a singing, if you listen to the song, she obviously can sing. She's got a lovely voice. So, and she sings in Sense and Sensibility as well. So they did this music video, and it's like these dramatic shots of her walking down hallways in this kind of gothic mansion, and it's interspersed with scenes from the animated movie. But I shocked the pants off my husband because he had no idea this existed. But I believe it was a top hit in the UK. I don't think it played on the radio here in the US, but I think it did in the UK. I would play a clip of it. Except I want to respect Kate, because I did see an interview with her from a few years back where a reporter surprised her by bringing a clip of it. And she seemed genuinely kind of like, no, turn that off. Like she, so I just, out of respect, I don't want to carnivalize it, if that makes sense. But I actually think it's a really beautiful song, and she looks really beautiful in the music video, and her voice is wonderful. So I don't think she should be embarrassed. I think it's fantastic and such a time capsule of a moment, but I, you know, sort of respect her and not play it, but she should definitely look it up. There is also The Life of David Gale, which I did not go back and rewatch because of the Kevin Spacey of it all. I can't do it. So I have not rewatched that one. But if you have thoughts about that movie, you know, I'm interested. And then we get to probably her second most iconic role, which is interesting that probably her two most iconic roles she did not win Oscars for, which is a travesty. But Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, which I know she has said before, you know, when she meets younger generations now, that like teenagers now that are going back and watching her films, that it's either Titanic or Eternal Sunshine that they latch onto, which makes perfect sense. Eternal Sunshine really changed for me what I thought movies were. I remember seeing it in the theater and being blown away by the quirky cuts and style. And I had up until that point mostly been watching, you know, very mainstream films. I just think what that movie does with timeline, with, you know, investigating memory and love and what love is, and Jim Carrey in this weird role that he just was wonderful in. And I wish we would have seen more of him like that at the time. But Kate, with the hair changes and the nervous energy, gosh, for some people, that's not their type of film. But if that is your type of film and you see humanity in that type of movie, then you are definitely a kindred spirit to me. It really opened up my eyes to seeing the world and film in a new way. You know, the colors in that movie are just should be studied in film school in terms of just evoking emotion. So, you know, I don't know what else to say except to just gush, and that if you haven't seen Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind in a while, I would go back and rewatch it. The two films around that time for me that really made me a different kind of cinema goer were Eternal and Lost in Translation. I had those two movie posters, you know, on my wall in college and grad school. Those were the two that shifted me more into being aware of what smaller films were saying, of what, you know, the films that were at the art house cinema and not necessarily at the Cinemark were saying, and being open to silences and quiet and more sort of humanistic dialogue and that sort of thing. So I definitely became a different type of moviegoer after those two movies. Finding Neverland, All the King's Men. You know, All the King's Men is interesting because it's based on the story of Huey P. Long. I grew up in Louisiana, and if you grew up in Louisiana, when you take Louisiana history in like 8th grade and again in 10th grade or whatever, all you hear is about Governor Huey P. Long and that, you know, very early 20th century type of politicking, you know, in the 20s and 30s. So, you know, it is very strange to me. I haven't rewatched it, but I probably should, not only for the Kate-ness of it, but also for just that legacy of being from Louisiana and seeing how it holds up. So in 2005 and 2006, it's three big things going on. Because we've got this run of Little Children, The Holiday, The Reader, and Revolutionary Road, which obviously for multiple reasons is meaningful. Okay, no, 2006 and 2008. I was about to say that would have been insane. No, 2006 is Little Children, and then 2008 is Okay, 2006 is Little Children and The Holiday. 2008 is The Reader and Revolutionary Road. So these are big moments. Little Children is, I think, again, a criminally forgotten movie. It's sort of a psychological love, not really a love story, but sort of just a psychological examination of in some pretty typical, normal people. It's based on a novel by Tom Perrotta. It's about this woman named Sarah, who Kate plays. She has a daughter and a husband who she doesn't really like that much. And she meets this law student who's sort of a stay-at-home dad. They both have kids around the same age. And it's about their relationship. It's a very quietly powerful movie. There's also a subplot involving the sex offender that moves into the neighborhood, and the fear around that takes place in the summer. It's very, the film will make you feel on edge, but in a very powerful way, I guess is the best way to say it. I think it is maybe her best performance, definitely in the top five. It is not talked about enough in its aftermath, but it was very well received at the time. Definitely was Oscar worthy. She did not win for it. But you know, you have that, her kind of, you know, showing, you know, even almost 10 years after Titanic, that she is going to keep surprising and taking on these really deep and complex roles and bringing again that feeling of the beauty and the charm of being a movie star, but with that willingness to grasp the gritty and to jump into some pretty hellish characters, hellish in the sense of what they're going through, of the complexities of their mind. And I mean, Leo does the same thing, right? He brings the same balance of movie star and this kind of gritty, this capability of bringing these very scarred and very human characters to life. So Little Children. And then that same year, The Holiday, which is on the complete opposite side of the universe. So both films, 2006 was a big year of me kind of rediscovering Kate. I remember Little Children is amazing. And again, not for kids, but you know, if you are wanting to kind of review some of her more dramatic work, it's the top choice. But The Holiday really is one of the only films that she's made that is insanely modern. You know, the Nancy Meyers aesthetic. The Holiday has obviously taken on a life of its own as a favorite, a Christmas favorite. I went last year to like revival of a 2006 movie, but showings at Alamo Drafthouse here in Austin. They had Christmas showings. It is, you know, iconic. I know so many people that that's their go-to holiday movie, which is weird because it's not weird. It's very holiday centered, and the scenes in England have a lot of snow, but there's really no Christmas scene if you think about it. But my argument is that the whole vibe of the film is that, you know, magical getaway feeling that you have when you sort of escape your normal life, but done at the holidays. And so I think that's why it feels so, I don't know, escapist and fun. I love it. I've seen it dozens of times. I mean, my husband is also in love with Kate Winslet. Kate ever hears this episode, she's going to think like, I need to stay away from that household. That's weird. But John, my husband, really, he says like, that's like the way she looks in that film. There's just no one more beautiful. And I agree 100%. I think it was just such a breath of fresh air to see her do something so light and fun. The scene with Eli Wallach in the restaurant where he says, you know, you're a leading lady, but you're acting like the best friend in the plot of your life. That scene pretty much changed my life. I returned to it again and again. I was going through a period in my life in my 20s when I was totally that character. I know she's obviously more in her maybe early 30s at that point, but I was in my early 20s and very much had those issues and very much in, incredibly unhealthy relationships that when I look back now, I cringe, and actually had a little bit of a Jasper character in my life. Oh gosh, I don't want to get into that. But anyway, that character, Iris in The Holiday, just all time, my heart, be still in my heart. I relate to her so much, and that Kate played that role. I sometimes watch that movie when it's not Christmas. So there you go. And so this sort of double whammy on both sides of range, you know, in 2006. And then in 2008, it's sort of a double whammy, but both heavily in the drama camp. The Reader, which she won her Oscar for, which is apparently a whole controversy. I didn't know this. I saw it on, not controversy, that's a hard word. Saw it on Twitter recently. There's this supposed debate about whether, you know, she should have won for The Reader, and is The Reader actually a great movie? And I have no interest in that debate, because for me, when I saw The Reader, I was I wasn't even a parent or anything at the time yet, but I was moved to tears. It was incredibly powerful. I've never been able to watch it again because it is so heartbreaking. But she wins for The Reader. She wins the double Golden Globe, I believe, for The Reader and for Revolutionary Road. And Revolutionary Road, obviously, is this reunion with Leo, which long awaited. And as someone who had been a fan of Titanic at 13, at least for me, and I think for a lot of people of my generation, to see them emerge together again, but in this dramatic, gut-wrenching portrayal of a marriage and the dark parts of it and the dark parts of, you know, kind of middle-class America in the middle of the 20th century. And if you've never read the novel that the movie is based on, it's Richard Yates, I believe. It's a great work in fiction and a great snapshot of a moment in American history, the cultural theme. So I mean, obviously it was a huge deal for me. I remember having like a little countdown on my notebook, you know, in grad school, like when the movie is coming out. And I think that film for Leo, I think I mentioned this in his episode I did. For him, I think that was a huge kind of breakthrough moment in his acting. I'd never seen him do anything quite like that before. And I think that was a moment where this whole new Leo came out in terms of dramatic acting. And I think it's no coincidence that it's, you know, alongside Kate with this bouncing off of her. Their chemistry is just out of this world. And I know that that movie, and it's directed by her husband at the time, Sam Mendes, who, you know, did American Beauty, won Oscars, recently did 1917, is a theater director as well. So renowned. I don't think it did financially or critically as well as people hoped at the time. I think there was this heightened level of expectation because of the two of them reuniting. But I stand by that film. Go back and rewatch it. To people that diss on it, I have no room for you. I think it is this very crucial moment in both of their filmographies. And also to any haters on her winning for The Reader, please, what do the young people say? Please at me. I would love to talk about it. So this is already getting long. Obviously, I just have so much love. There's Contagion, which, man, like what a random, rather small, rather small role for her to turn into really what has become one of her most resonating roles, just because of the meaning that Contagion has taken on in terms of COVID. I don't know if you guys remember at the beginning of COVID in March of 2020, I remember seeing all of these articles and podcasts who were doing rewatches of, you know, people were returning to this movie as some sort of weird comfort mechanism. I have not been able to do that. Movie scared the hell out of me at the time. And in light of COVID, I know it would more so. So I've never been able to rewatch it. I remember that scene where her character dies and she just goes into the pit with the other bodies and it's like her dead eyes. But I think, you know, that turned into weirdly one of her iconic movies. She's in the Divergent series, which I liked. My husband liked those books. I think I read the first book. We went to go see them in the theater, and this was before we had kids. I think they're great. I think obviously they were made in the wake of the success of The Hunger Games, and there was some amount of capitalizing on that. But I think, you know, it makes perfect sense that Kate would jump into, you know, at least one of these franchise sort of film sets. It's what everybody is doing. I know that sometimes actors and actresses take flack for doing that, but, you know, it makes sense. Like, it increases your visibility. Those are the roles that pay really well. And that's where film is going. It was already, you know, 10, 15 years ago, that's already where film was headed, into these major franchises. And so to stay on top of being relevant, this is what people do. I want to mention a couple from the kind of 2010s. Steve, I don't know why I laughed right there, except for the fact that there is a, I'm recording in my husband's office. My office is not yet ready in the new house, but he has a stuffed baby Daisy, like from Mario, on his desk because our kids love it and gave him one as a present. I'm just like looking at her as I do this. Sorry. So I want to mention a couple from this era. Steve Jobs had totally missed it when it came out. Michael Fassbender as Steve Jobs, Kate Winslet playing Joanna Hoffman, his marketing executive, like right-hand woman. There's been some talk about her accent work in this movie. I actually think it's really great. And that's something I haven't even mentioned yet, is her ability to master accents. This is something that follows her throughout her career. But I had sort of missed that movie. And then a couple of years ago, it popped up on Netflix as available and randomly watched it. I think so well done. And I'm not someone who knows a lot about the history of Steve Jobs, so I can't speak to how accurate it is, but it's a great film. And then I want to thank my friend Hank, who not only listens, but she's been a really, really big supporter of the show and one of the people, you know, in my real life that has kind of bridges that, you know, the Titanic love and real life friend. So thank you, Hank. But thank you for bringing The Dressmaker into my life. I had missed this one, and it is just a wild ride. It is an Australian film. She plays a woman who comes back to her tiny little town that she had left, you know, frantically because she didn't feel like she fit in. And she comes back, and there's just this wild cast of characters in this small town. Sarah Snook, who's on Succession, she's in it. A lot of people you'll recognize. It's one of the Hemsworth brothers. Which one is it? I can't even remember. I actually don't want to ruin much because that's still a fairly recent film. And if you haven't seen it, watch it. I believe it's still on Amazon Prime. I think she maybe won some awards in Australia for this, and rightly so. But she's in these gorgeous costumes because she played her character, like, left, became a fashion designer, and it takes place like in the mid 20th century. So it's kind of a costume drama. Oh my God, just some crazy stuff happened. So thank you, Hank, for bringing that. I don't know how many years I would have waited before I finally watched that. So thank you. 999, Collateral Beauty. I don't know much about these movies. I know they are weirdly both available on Netflix right now, so maybe I finally need to dip into them. But the one I want to talk about from kind of her recent era, before we get to Mare of Easttown and Ammonite and Avatar, which I think is sort of representative of the next level of her career and so important, or not level, next phase, I guess would be the word. But I do want to talk about The Mountain Between Us. So this movie was a bit panned by critics, from what I remember. And I remember even, you know, having that impression that I was very upset that critics seemed to turn on it, and it made me scared to watch it. It is her and Idris Elba, and it is really her as a return to, I don't know, just an earnest kind of love story, which I found weirdly comforting, even though the premise is really scary. She and Idris Elba are strangers that randomly end up on this kind of jump flight to, is it Alaska? Where are they? Are they in the Dakotas? I can't remember where they are. Wintry climate. They end up on this jump flight trying to get to like the Denver airport, and they're just with this pilot who takes them out on this hired flight, and they crash in the mountains, very remote, and the pilot dies, and it is sort of a survivalist story. There's a dog involved. At first blush, sounds cheesy, but man, it is so good. If you are listening to this and you host a film podcast and you do episodes on little appreciated movies, or, you know, like, come on and talk about a movie you randomly love, I will come on your podcast and I will talk about this movie. I will defend it till the cows come home. It is a wonderful love story. She and Idris Elba have amazing chemistry. It's probably only second to her and Leo. The dialogue and the humanity and how they speak with one another is just wonderful. It's beautifully shot in the snow. And I think the reason that people act out and speak out against movies like it is, I think as a culture, unfortunately, we have become very averse to very earnest and sweet love stories. And that is what this movie is. It is a story about two people falling in love. I think we have this reflex now in society to like, oh, that's too earnest. That's too sweet. That's too like human. I don't know. It's like we have to pile extra layers and meanings. And I think some people are just kind of scared of that earnestness. But if you've never seen it and you're a fan of love stories that are well made, please see it and let me know what you think. There also was a little gem a few years ago called Blackbird, and I believe it's now on Amazon. She plays Susan Sarandon's daughter, and it's about this whole family that comes together to set rather dark at the impending death of the mother, Susan Sarandon, and does have some themes of assisted suicide. So definitely trigger warning on that as a film, but it is a beautiful little movie. I don't know why it was kind of buried. Didn't really seem to get a lot of press. I don't know if it's because of the themes in it, but it is a moving little picture, as they say. So I want to say that in the pandemic, there was obviously this Kate Winslet renaissance. And I say it that way hesitantly because I don't, again, carnivalize. I don't even know if that's a word. But I don't want to turn it into like a carnival. I don't want to just jump on the train of Kate Winslet renaissance and make it sound like something silly. For me, it was a very, very important thing. That not that she'd gone anywhere. I mean, she obviously was making good movies and has always been making good movies. But there really was this moment during the pandemic where you have, you know, Ammonite, her film with Saoirse Ronan about Mary Anning, which was, you know, not weird for her to do because it is a period piece, but just, you know, kind of a shock to the system to see her as Mary Anning, this very plain but beautiful woman with a very tortured past in this quiet role where she's very quietly, like there are so many moments with no dialogue in this movie, very quietly falling in love with this younger woman. The movie, in terms of its critical reception, suffered a little bit because so recently there had been Portrait of a Lady on Fire, which people had kind of viewed as, you know, the lesbian period romance movie, and made me so mad that people immediately compared the two. It's so degrading to think that just because two movies are period films and happen to be about, you know, same-sex relationships between women, that we have to compare them, because they really had nothing to do with one another other than that. So it's a little degrading, I think, in terms of conceptualizing the movie. It made me so mad. Like, why can't these two stand separate, both as excellent films? And I love Portrait of a Lady on Fire. Stunning movie. But Ammonite was stunning as well, and different. And so it was very very frustrating to see those comparisons made. But that said, I do think that most people appreciated Ammonite for what a thoughtful work it was. And so there was this Ammonite moment, and it was available on streaming pretty quickly because of the pandemic, which was unfortunate in the sense that I think had it not been pandemic times, that film would have been on the film festival circuit and probably gotten a lot more attention. But that led in also to this Mayor of Easttown moment. And Mayor of Easttown, I have never felt such a powerful meeting of my undying love for somebody with a cult monocultural moment. I felt so validated. Not that Kate Winslet needs me to be validated about her. She doesn't. I felt so validated. I can't tell you how many people came to me during the Mayor of Easttown, run on HBO and said, "Oh my God, you're right. It's Kate forever. It's Kate forever. She's amazing. Here she comes again." And she emerges as mayor, as this working class woman, and she masters the accent. I have heard on a couple of podcasts I listen to that have hosts that are from the region in, Pennsylvania, where this takes place, that she nailed the accent. So once again, but she just becomes this working class woman who is struggling with what motherhood is, what relationships are, what her role is as a mother, as a grandmother, as a police officer, the whole world that is created, and Julianne Nicholson's character and their relationship, their friendship. And I won't ruin the show because there are probably some people that haven't finished it or haven't watched it, and it's so recent. But I mean, we were all just watching week to week, Evan Peters' character. Oh my gosh. And I watched, my husband and I watched the first episode, and he always watches anything Kate or Leo with me when it first comes out. But he, I said, "You're not beholden to sticking with it, but watch the first episode with me." And we both turned off that first episode and looked at each other and just like, okay, we're hooked. Like, I'll just sit on this couch until the next episode posts. But I mean, in a time where we don't have many monocultural moments that aren't pertaining to Marvel movies or Top Gun, I think it was a testament to her power as an actress and as a cultural icon that we all came together for that. Just blows my mind. And I actually am going to this summer go back and do a rewatch. But in terms of a show, the mystery, the intrigue, but also just the humanity. Anyway, Mare Forever. And I think the most amazing part about it is that Kate Winslet really shows us as Mare that beauty comes from confidence and sort of a truth in yourself, but also in the lines in a face that come from life and come from trauma and suffering. Mare is stripped bare. They put makeup and hair on Kate in that role to make her look like a tired working class woman who is suffering. But she still looks stunningly gorgeous because the truth of how she portrays that woman is just shines through. And in every scene, she is stunning. And, she said in a recent tribute to Helen Mirren, I think it was for the Screen Actors Guild Award, there's this great quote from Kate where she says, "Women, we're proving, get better with age as well." And it's so true. And we live in a world where, unfortunately, women start, changing their face, changing their body via surgery as early as, 18, 19 years old. We live in a world where it's like, oh yeah, get some lip filler. It's no big deal. It's just like, it's so crazy to me. And we live in this world where we see these unattainable beauty standards that aren't even real on Instagram and everything. And you don't need me to go into all of that. We all know those debates. But what Kate shows us is that women, as not just men, but women without all of that, really do get better with age. And the lines on your face or expressions on your face or how you carry yourself, the confidence with which you carry yourself. That's what makes you beautiful. And she, I don't know, I think she's more beautiful than ever with every passing year. And when she said that in that speech, I got up and I stood from my couch because this has been this has been a pet peeve of mine for so long. The, you know, men get better with age. Steve Carell looks better older, you know, Bradley Cooper, like whoever. It's always made me so mad that women haven't been allowed to say that. But women, we get better with age too, like 100%. So I think there's also this pandemic moment, you know, with that, with Mare, and Kate Winslet kind of became this, you know, she's not on social media, but kind of became a social media icon for showing and holding up this example of unaltered beauty on an actress that is aging, you know, allowing herself to age in a very naturalistic way. So anyway, I hope I haven't overstepped by talking about that a little bit. I approached this episode, not that she ever will, but I approached this episode by saying to myself, you know, if Kate ever came across this and listened to it, I don't want to say anything that I wouldn't say right to her face or want to talk about directly with her. So anyway, I say that with just the utmost respect, and really was, I don't know, as a role model, the Mare moment was important. So as important to me in terms of Kate as the Titanic moment was. Those are like twin moments for me. All right. Okay. Avatar, it's coming out this December. I'll have my butt in that seat with the advance ticket at the Alamo Drafthouse. Everyone's like, Kate said she'd never work with Jim Cameron again. Whatever. That was 25 years ago. And I mean, of course she worked with him again. He's one of the greatest filmmakers of all time. And he never disappoints. And everybody's like, why do we need all these Avatar sequels? Well, he's going to show us. So I just would recommend getting tickets early because it's all going to sell out and it's going to be amazing. Kate, I love you. from my 13-year-old self to my 37-year-old self, thank you for... Oh, I should mention too, totally forgot to mention, she talks about some of this like image, beauty ideals, things like this in her Bear Grylls episode. She did an episode with Running Wild with Bear Grylls. And it's so fun. He, you know, I don't know if you've ever watched that show, but he takes celebrities on like a 2-day little jaunt through difficult terrain, and they have to do like outdoor activities and they sleep outside and eat weird things. But her episode is really good. She's really honest. She's really open. You can see the fear in her eyes when she's scared. She talks really frankly about being a mother and about her daughter. So anyway, highly recommend that. All right, we are running long already. So I am going to read a couple of notes before I play the ones I received. I'm going to read a couple of notes that I got about Kate from you guys. And after I read those, I'm going to play a couple of voicemails that I received. And then after that, we'll come back with a few thoughts about closing out season one and what's to come in the fall. This first Kate note is from Hermes. I hope I'm pronouncing your name correctly. Thank you. And thank you for being such an avid supporter of the show. He says, I absolutely fell in love with Kate when I saw her in Titanic. What all the girls around the world were feeling for Leo DiCaprio, I was feeling for her. She was not only gorgeous, but felt incredibly human and real. Rose is a very complex character with a huge range of emotions, and Kate really nailed the performance. From her innocence and sadness to her joy of living, from falling in love with Jack to being that classic James Cameron tough woman, Kate did it all. As the years went by, I found myself amazed at her talent and her capacity to bring such humanity and such complex emotions to all her characters. And no matter how small the role, she always rose to the occasion. No pun intended. There are three things I love about her. First is her voice, which is probably the most beautiful voice in the history of cinema. I agree. I own an audiobook in which she reads Roald Dahl's Matilda, and it's a thing of beauty. Second, her sense of humor. It's always fascinating to me seeing her bloopers or fooling around on set. You should totally watch her appearance in Ricky Gervais's Extras. I agree with that too, where she plays herself. And third, the way she performs the smallest of things. To me, that's always the definitive proof of an actor's talent. But look at the way she eats on camera, or how she wakes up, or how she answers the phone. Such a pleasure to watch. And that's all from me. Thanks for the show. Thank you. That was a great message. Now, four, the second message that I am about to read, I want to just share a little story. A few nights ago when this message came in, my son had my cell phone upstairs and he was playing like a color by number game or something. And he shouts, guys, I was at a heart attack. He shouts down the stairs, "Mommy, you have an email from Kate Winslet." And of course, I'm crazy. So of course, in my head, I'm thinking, oh my God, did Kate Winslet find my podcast and she's emailing me? And it, like, my husband and I looked at each other like, oh, could it be? And then I quickly realized it probably was just like subject line Kate Winslet. And that's what it was. But I just want to thank you, Katja, for, and I hope I'm pronouncing your name correctly as well, for bringing that moment into my life, because it was your email that did that. So, and she was currently on a cruise when she wrote this message. So that's amazing. And she said that she's already reached double digits on how many times she's mentioned Titanic on this cruise at this point when she emailed this. So here is her message. "I was only three when the movie came out, Titanic, but when I watched it, people probably by age eight, I was obsessed. I talked about her and the film nonstop. It didn't occur to me until I was 24 and realized I was in fact a woman not necessarily attracted to men, that a big reason I argued for Rose being the greatest character written ever was that I was a little bit in love with her. Should have guessed when everyone my age was obsessed with Leo and I wondered why no one talked about the beautiful redhead. Kate went through so much in terms of body image struggle with the media. That is true. The things they said about her in magazines stuck with me forever. I couldn't believe this woman who seemed so perfect was viewed as unhealthy. Reading this permanently damaged how I saw myself. And still, 25 years later, she has fought against photoshopping her image on covers. She has. It's amazing. And fought for women being viewed as more than a number on a scale or the size of their dress. She is also an ally to LGBTQIA+ community, which obviously means a lot to me. She stands for the things that are important to her. I think she's created such a beautiful space for young people to grow. Her young co-star on Mayor of Easttown can probably attest to that. I have adored this woman for as long as I can remember. She will be my celebrity crush until the sun implodes." Me too. "My favorite roles of hers are probably from Eternal Sunshine of a Spotless Mind and Mayor of Easttown, with an honorable mention going to The Dressmaker. This email is already too long, but I feel it doesn't fully encapsulate what she means to me." It's not too long, by the way. I'll wrap it up before it gets weird. It's not weird. "Thank you for listening and doing an episode on her." Thank you for sending in that message. That's amazing. Thank you. All right. I am going to play a couple of voicemails that I received. Here we go.
"Hey, my name is Erin, longtime Titanic fan and listener of the pod. And I wanted to drop a note about the indomitable Kate Winslet. She is one of the only actresses I feel I've actually grown up with. She's someone I've followed throughout the years, and I've been able to see her mature as an actress and as a woman. She's faced so many things in the public eye that we, as women, face in our own lives, in albeit a less public way. Comments about her weight, her age, the way she looks, etc. And her response to this has been, instead of bowing to outside ideas about how the industry thinks she should look or act, is to be exceptionally vocal about maintaining her authenticity. In Mayor of Easttown on HBO, she refused to wear a ton of makeup. Her look was authentic to her character, and there's many articles about just how hard she had to fight to look like a normal woman in a show about a normal woman. After Titanic, she refused to stick to the narrative that her weight should be the same as it was in the movie. Whether or not that was an easy or necessary choice for her, she was not the typical stick-thin starlet that Hollywood prizes, and yet she is unquestionably one of the most beautiful women in film. She doesn't have social media with edited photos depicting a perfect life or collecting likes for her dinner choices. I think what we love about her is that she is inexorably herself. She has her own life outside of film, and she's not going to allow her career to alter that or alter her perception of herself. I think, in a sense, that the way we saw her come of age in Titanic was only the beginning of the true coming of age of Kate Winslet. Rose learned that being herself was the most important thing to her, and Kate has perpetuated that idea throughout her entire career. The idea that authenticity is not something to be embarrassed of, but rather something that we should take pride in pursuing. The narrative around our lives does not need to be the narrative of our lives. And I, for one, as a millennial facing the narrative that my 20s actually were not my greatest years, despite what society tells us, can appreciate having a role model that hasn't remained frozen in time with one of my favorite movies, but has instead grown with me and has given a face and a voice to this very real theme that one movie only showed one part of. And I'm thankful for it. We love us some Kate Winslet.
So what does Kate Winslet mean to me? When I think of Kate, I think of someone who's unapologetically authentic. You know, I was 12 when I saw Titanic. I think very similar in age to you, and immediately she took my breath away. That red hair, those striking eyes, and the enormous purple hat. And I've been smitten ever since. As a woman and a mother now, you know, I see Kate in a different light. As a teenager, I held so tight to that motto. She would say, "I am who I am, like it or lump it." And I thought, yes, because I remember being the pudgy kid and just really struggling with loving myself for who I was. And now that I'm in this different chapter of life, it's just the fact that she is unapologetically authentic. Hollywood be damned. Doesn't matter. And she's a strong woman. She doesn't take bullshit from anyone. And she lives with that transparency. And it's something I'm grateful for. I have not found the same sense of identity or leadership in any other woman in the industry. And I still find her inspiring. And I found out when I was pregnant with my first baby and had to have a C-section that she had a C-section too. And she had a successful VBAC, vaginal birth after cesarean. And that was something I clung to when I was going for my VBAC as well. So thank you for bringing light to her. She's fantastic. And so is this podcast. And so are you.
Kate Winslet for being Kate Winslet!
All right. Thank you for being on the podcast with me, you guys. I know it was a lot to kind of put yourself out there like that. And you guys said more eloquently than I could what she means. So thank you. I know it seems a little random to do the season finale with just all these Kate thoughts, but I guess it's not random at all. Like I said earlier, a big realization for me has just been the joy of the marriage of the history of the ship with bonding with all of you over the cultural history of the 97 movie. And I, you know, unabashedly just, that's something I obsess over, the 97 movie. It brings me such childlike joy, and I will never stop. And I have heard from a lot of you that that's how you feel as well. So the show will continue to be a balance of those two things. I had a listener have a really good idea for season 2 that I could do a series of episodes about characters from the movie and then their real life counterparts and what the movie got right and what the movie got wrong. People like Archibald Gracie, Margaret Brown. So that is definitely on the docket. I'm definitely going to do that. The 97 episodes have by far, data-wise, been my most popular episodes, which is not surprising. I think a lot of you want to talk about the movie along with the ship. So I will do some of those, but I will definitely be digging into tons of history on the ship in season two as well. Some more profile episodes on, you know, passengers. Really need to dig into third class more. I have not done that yet. I want to do some profiles on some third class passengers. Please email me at unsinkablepod@gmail.com or leave a voicemail. I'll leave my voicemail number in the show notes. Over the summer, if you have a book club suggestion, I'm going to keep book episodes going. If you have just a suggestion for an episode, I don't have my docket of fall episodes fully complete yet. It's still in the works. So please let me know if you have any ideas. I also, like I said at the beginning, I really am going to work towards having some episodes that have a little bit more of a conversational style, and I will be doing definitely a series of episodes on my travels. I am going to, knock on wood, as long as COVID allows us and stays kind of on the right trajectory, we are booking and planning a trip to Ireland and Northern Ireland and England in August. So I will be at the Titanic Experience in Cove. I will be at the Titanic Experience in Belfast and seeing tons of Titanic spots in between. We'll be in Ireland for a while and then we'll be in Liverpool. Just Titanic all around. My husband is a huge Liverpool soccer fan. So basically the two lead points of our trip are Titanic things and Liverpool things. And luckily our two interests combine. So I will definitely be doing a series of episodes on the travels. If you live in one of those locations and you have recommendations for dining, for sites, for Titanic sites, please email me or message me on Instagram. And I will continue to be active on socials throughout the summer. I'm not going anywhere. I'm just taking a little bit of a break from, you know, producing the main feed episodes. They're just a lot of work and I want to do them correctly and properly. And in the summer, I just don't have the time, as I mentioned earlier. I don't know. I don't know how to end season one, except to say, I love you guys. There are so many of you who have been listening since episode one. You randomly found it and you've been here. I have had an outpouring of support on email, Instagram, Twitter. I love interacting with you guys. I like being part of the conversation. Some of you could school me on some aspects of Titanic. So I have loved feedback and constructive criticism. I want your suggestions. I want your feedback always 100% of the time. Never hesitate. If I get something wrong, if you think I should do something differently, please reach out. This has been the best experience. I started in, you know, the fall of last year thinking, well, if I do a couple of episodes and it feels good, maybe I'll stick with it. And I was still a little hesitant about letting my obsession out into the world, but it has just, I have met so many wonderful people. Thank you to all of my guests over the course of season one, all the way back to Veronica Hinkey, who came on as the first guest on a brand new podcast. She took a chance on me. And, you know, I just want to thank everybody who's come on as a guest, as a book club episode guest. I have had some renowned people on the podcast, and for a pod to be, yeah, so new and about something so niche, that's a really big deal. So thank you to everyone for listening. Thank you to my guests. Season one, let's close the book, but we're opening a new one in just a couple of months with season two. I will see you here in the fall for lots more Unsinkable. Watch the feed, stay subscribed, make sure you're subscribed because, like I said, I might do a couple of special episodes over the course of the summer. Consider joining Patreon if you want to continue getting some content from Unsinkable over the summer. Yeah, I'm like kind of, I know I sound weird right now. I'm a little bit worked up. I don't know what else to say except thank you. It's a delight, and it's become such a passion of mine to do this podcast. So yes, stay subscribed. Rate and review if you've enjoyed it as a season ending kind of thing. If you haven't done that yet, it would mean a lot. And follow on socials, Twitter, Instagram, Unsinkable Pod. Like I said, I'll be on there. And yeah, I'll talk soon, guys. Hope you have a wonderful summer and stay unsinkable.
What exactly has got into you?
I don't know. What I've got is something slightly resembling gumption.